Do you think it's possible for people in this country, for, as Joe Biden says, 100 million people to be vaccinated in the first 100 days of his administration?
I think that's stretching it, frankly. It would be wonderful if so. I really would prefer to get if I get a first shot, I'd prefer to get a second shot, because that's where the 95% effectiveness lies. But I'm at this point, I think anything that's going to get this process accelerated will be a good thing.
Dr. Peter Salk, his father, Dr. Jonas Salk, developed the first polio vaccine. We thank you so much for being with us. Now a professor of infectious disease and microbiology at University of Pittsburgh. We'll link to your piece. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask. It's an act of love.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 18th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 18th from 5:45 p.m. to 7 p.m., streaming online. The event honors the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and reflects on the relevance of his message in today's challenges. The evening will include songs, readings, and a keynote presentation, The Power of Resilience by Cameron Witten. Again, that's the 18th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 18th from 5:45 p.m. to 7 p.m. streaming online. More information can be found on the right side of the KBOO homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge may require Portland police officers to wear body cameras if they're carrying so-called less lethal weapons during protests. Oregon will not be receiving the additional coronavirus vaccines promised by Health and Human Service Secretary Alex Azar. And Portland City Council joins in the call for reparations to Black and Indigenous Americans. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 15th, 2021. I'm Nat Moon. On Monday, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar announced that additional doses of the coronavirus vaccine that were being held in reserve would be released to the states. In a statement, he said, quote, "We are releasing the entire supply we have for order by states, rather than holding second doses in physical reserve," end quote. On Tuesday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced that the additional doses would allow for an expansion of the pool of recipients to include all teachers and people over 65. She indicated that the rollout of additional vaccines would begin on January 23rd when the additional vaccines arrived. But last night, Gustav Perna, the chief operating officer of Operation Warp Speed, advised the governor that there were no additional doses and that the state's allocation remained unchanged. In a tweet this morning regarding the lack of additional doses, Brown called the misleading information, quote, deception on a national scale. The miscommunication between federal and state governments is just the latest setback for a vaccine rollout that has been mismanaged from the start. The Trump administration initially promised that 20 million would be vaccinated by the end of 2020, but only 11 million doses were distributed, and only about 2 million received their first vaccination. But the federal government didn't provide guidelines or support for the distribution, and when questioned about the failure to get close to the goal, administration officials blamed the states. In the meantime, the pandemic continues to rage practically unchecked, with over 235,000 new cases and nearly 4,000 deaths reported nationwide yesterday. On Wednesday, U.S. District Court Judge Marco Hernandez said that he is considering requiring Portland police officers to wear body cameras if they are armed with so-called less lethal weapons during protests. The judge also said he wants to see rotations in the PPB's rapid response team, so the same officers aren't on the street night after night, and that officers should get training every 6 months on when it's appropriate to fire. The possible restrictions come as a result of finding the police in contempt of his June order restricting the use of so-called less lethal munitions during protests in Portland. In November, Hernandez ruled that his order was violated three times during a June 30th protest at the police union office in North Portland, where officers repeatedly fired at people who weren't aggressive. Hernandez has scheduled a hearing for February 9th and notified city attorneys and lawyers for the nonprofit Don't Shoot Portland that they have until January 29th to respond to his proposed sanctions. In a statement, the judge said, quote, "I want grenadiers and other people using non-lethal weapons to be able to articulate to the court, before that weapon is used, what the specific danger was prior to the pulling of that trigger." He said those responses would be made available in reports to the public. The judge said that he does not favor an outright ban on the so-called less lethal weapons, but wishes to ensure that they are only used when necessary, saying, quote, "The goal of the court is to make sure the behavior that occurred doesn't repeat itself." The city of Portland is planning to push the federal government to provide reparations to Black and Indigenous communities. The request was included as the top racial justice priority in Portland's annual federal policy agenda that was approved by the City Council just last week. Although long considered a non-starter at the national level, support for reparations to descendants of enslaved African Americans or Native Americans who are harmed by government policies has been growing in recent years. President-elect Joe Biden has vowed to focus on systemic racial inequality, and last week, Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson reintroduced a bill that would create a commission to consider reparations for descendants of slavery. The proposal has never made it to a full House vote before, but currently there are 173 co-sponsors to the bill, including Oregon Democratic Representatives Earl Blumenauer, Suzanne Bonamici, and Peter DeFazio. On Wednesday, contract discussions between the Portland Police Association and the city got underway, with both sides agreeing that the new contract needed to restore public trust in the PPB, but there was little initial agreement on how to do that. With increasing public demand for police reform, city negotiators cited significant changes they wanted to see in the new contract, including additional education requirements, the ability for city officials to be able to publicly comment on misconduct, and officer performance evaluations that could result in discipline. But Anil Karia, the lawyer for the 880-member union, pushed back, saying the union was opposed to, quote, public shaming of officers. The current contract has a so-called embarrassment clause requiring that officer reprimands be done in ways, quote, least likely to embarrass them in public. Karia also called for officer evaluations to be based on constructive rather than potentially punitive feedback. A potential sticking point is the November ballot measure that created a community board to investigate police misconduct. The measure passed with overwhelming support, but the union immediately filed a grievance saying the city broke the labor agreement. But the city negotiator said that the measure is no part of these talks and will be included in future discussions once the committee decides its structure and makeup. Caria argued that the PPB is understaffed and facing a record number of retirements and resignations. He claimed that staff shortage was directly responsible for a more than doubling of police response times over the last 8 years. The next public bargaining session is set for February 10th. If agreement on a new contract is not reached within 5 months, each side will present its last best offer to an arbitrator. A new poll has shown bipartisan support for protection of the Owyhee Canyon lands in southeastern Oregon. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Protecting the Owyhee Canyon lands is a popular idea for people from both major political parties, according to a new poll. Polling firm John Zogby Strategies finds 79% of likely Oregon voters would back legislation in Congress to protect this landscape, including 89% of Democrats, 65% of Republicans, and 80% of people who identify as independents. John Zogby is founder of the polling firm.
It's safe to say that while there may have been some differences, say, between Democrats and Republicans, between liberals and conservatives, that the support really was strong across the board.
Past attempts by Oregon's delegation to protect the Owyhees haven't gained traction. However, a portion of the Owyhee River and surrounding canyons already are federally protected on the Idaho side of the border. The poll was commissioned by Citizens for the Republic, a political action committee founded by Ronald Reagan in 1977. The poll also finds high percentages of support for protecting the environment and rivers in general, among both liberals and conservatives. While the left is usually associated with environmental causes, Zogby doesn't find it surprising that conservatives also back conservation causes. He references polling he did before the 2000 election.
The support for conservation, for preserving the environment, was very, very strong. In fact, in some instances, stronger than their opposition to abortion. And so this is one area of commonality that we can count on.
On the Owyhee Canyon lands, the poll also found support from a variety of groups, including 63% of hunters, 64% of anglers, and 68% of gun owners. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Representative Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington joined other Republican House members in voting to impeach President Trump on Wednesday. Prior to Wednesday's vote, Herrera Butler of Vancouver signaled that she intended to vote to impeach. In a statement, she said, quote, "The president's offenses, in my reading of the Constitution, were impeachable based on the indisputable evidence that we already have," end quote. Her vote brought praise from both Democrats and some Republicans, but that principled stand also brought along a considerable political risk. Prior to the vote, the group Clark County Republican Women sent a letter to Herrera Butler warning her of the consequences of a vote to impeach. The CCRW demanded that she reconsider her vote and said, quote, "If you cast this vote to impeach, you will never receive our support or votes again at any time in the future. Additionally, we will do everything in our power as the largest Republican women's organization in Washington state to recruit and elect a conservative candidate who will represent our values," end quote. Dan Newhouse, another Washington Republican representative, also voted to impeach. At this point, it is unclear if he too has been threatened by fellow Republicans. A 15-year-old Columbia County individual has been accused of causing more than $46,000 in damage in the city of Portland. The youth was arrested 2 weeks ago and is accused of burglary, attempted burglary, criminal mischief, and riot during the demonstrations that took place in downtown Portland on December 31st and January 1st. According to the Portland police, surveillance video showed the individual committing crimes at numerous locations during the demonstration, which was declared a riot. During the riot, windows were broken and walls graffitied at two Starbucks locations, as well as the Portland Wine Bar, Benbridge Jewelers, Pandora, and Chase Bank. Recent actions in Washington, D.C. and Portland have raised questions about the ability of the U.S. experiment in democracy to continue. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
Road rage can be described as aggressive driving behavior that can range from rude gestures and verbal insults all the way to physical confrontations and even murder. It results from the anger and frustration over the actions of other drivers, and safety experts say that it is the primary cause of thousands of auto accidents every year. Unfortunately, it appears we need to add a new type of rage to the lexicon, voter rage. And as we saw in Washington, D.C. last week, it can result in violent outbursts sparked by individuals who are frustrated by events over which they have little or no control. In that case, it was anger and frustration over the mistaken belief that the presidential election was stolen from their hero, Donald Trump. That anger and frustration exploded on January 6th and may be with us for years to come. But sadly, this behavior does not appear to be limited to just right-wing supporters. This past Wednesday, 1 week after the Trump-inspired riots in Washington, I read that Portland Commissioner Dan Ryan's home had been vandalized 7 times since last October. Ryan apparently fueled left-wing anger by providing the swing vote in the November City Council vote on whether to cut an additional $18 million out of the Portland Police Bureau's budget, on top of the $15 million that had been cut in June. And it's not just Ryan. The home of the lawyer for the Portland Police Association had his home vandalized Monday night while he and his family were there. Evidently, it was an attempt to intimidate him as the city enters into contract negotiations with the police union. Last week, Mayor Wheeler was accosted while attempting to eat dinner, and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has received death threats at her home and apparently had at least one shot fired at her office. This is not the way democracy is supposed to work, even a clearly imperfect one like the one we have in the U.S. A small but vocal and possibly violent group of people does not get to make the rules. That's why we vote. And sometimes we lose, often on issues that are near and dear to us. But anger over your loss does not give you the right to violence and intimidation, whether you're an alt-right mob spurred on by a lying president or a well-intentioned citizen pushing for change in your local police department. There are rules to this game called democracy, and we break those rules at our peril. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect a cloudy evening with an overnight low of 40. Tomorrow, we can look forward to a cloudy day with some sun and the chance of a passing shower. On this day in 2001, the collaborative online encyclopedia, Wikipedia, went online. Wikipedia is maintained by a vast number of volunteer editors and is the 13th most visited address on the World Wide Web. Today's quote is from Sue Gardner, the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation from 2007 to 2014. She said, quote, "Everybody's saying be skeptical of Wikipedia. That is true. They should be skeptical of everything. We should all be critical consumers of media." Lawmakers in Washington are holding hearings today on an expansion of the state's paid family leave laws. For more on that, here's Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service.
The paid family and medical leave program has been a source of relief for Washingtonians who have been sick or were caring for loved ones during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, state legislators would like to see it go further. Lawmakers hold a hearing today on House Bill 1073, which would expand the program to more people, especially low-wage workers. State Representative Liz Berry introduced the legislation, the first of her career in Olympia.
Knowing that we're going to be dealing with that throughout the remainder of 2021, I think it makes sense to treat this as a priority emergency legislation this next session so that more workers can enjoy it.
HB 1073 would change the qualifying threshold so more workers can access it. It also would expand the definition of family and ensure that small businesses with fewer than 50 employees protect workers' jobs and continue their health insurance. Since the program began in 2020, 170,000 workers have applied for benefits. Marilyn Watkins at the Economic Opportunity Institute says the legislation aims to bring Washington in line with other states that have paid leave programs, including Oregon. She says ensuring workers at smaller businesses have a job to come back to would be an important improvement on the current program, which doesn't guarantee that.
That can be a real disincentive for people to take the leave or to take the full amount that they're entitled to and really need for their own health and the health of their family members.
Berry says supporting the program is personal, citing her own experience with her 4-year-old son.
When I was pregnant with him, my employer didn't have a paid family and medical leave program, and I was really disappointed in that. I knew my employer could do better, and so when I came to lead that organization just a few months later, I changed that policy.
The bill's public hearing in the House Committee on Labor and Workplace Standards is scheduled for 8 a.m. today. The Senate holds a hearing on a similar bill on Monday. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
To no one's great surprise, a report has confirmed that police in the United States are 3 times more likely to use violence against left-wing protesters than right-wing protesters. The report comes from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project and is based on a statistical database created by a collaboration with researchers at Princeton University. The researchers found that the vast majority of the thousands of demonstrations that took place in the United States in 2020 were peaceful and were not met by any violent responses by police. But when law enforcement did react violently, those on the left were more likely to face tear gas, rubber bullets, beatings by police, and so on. For left-wing protests, police violence occurred nearly 5% of the time, while right-wing protesters suffered just under 1.5% of the time. The 3-to-1 ratio held true even when protesters were peaceful and not involved in any sort of violence, vandalism, or looting. The majority of the left-wing protests in the report were categorized as part of Black Lives Matter, pro-Biden, abolish ICE, NAACP, and Democratic Socialist movements. Right-wing rallies were identified as being associated with pro-Trump groups, police support groups, against coronavirus public health restrictions, QAnon supporters, and others associated with the Stop the Steal and similar movements. States across the country are increasing security in anticipation of possible Inauguration Day violence, and Joe Biden proposes an ambitious economic relief plan. With more on those stories and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 transition and uncharted territory.
Just as we respect and will protect peaceful protesters, we will also just as vigorously resist violence.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and other state leaders are beefing up security after FBI warnings of possible armed protests leading up to the inauguration. Organizations that track right-wing extremists say there's online chatter planning more violence. Utah Governor Spencer Cox says they're preparing.
We are bringing in all of our reserves that we can with the Highway Patrol. They will be ready this weekend. And the National Guard will be on standby.
To improve safety on flights to and from D.C., the TSA is increasing security screenings, and some airlines are banning guns and alcohol. President-elect Joe Biden announced his American Rescue Plan last night, nearly $2 trillion to pull the country out of the economic crisis, including $1,400 direct stimulus checks, $160 billion for a national vaccine program, a $15 an hour federal minimum wage, and billions invested for education, childcare, nutrition programs, and more. On a call yesterday, incoming First Lady Dr. Jill Biden told military families she's ready to work with them to relaunch Joining Forces, a support program she co-founded with First Lady Michelle Obama.
This has been an incredible time for Joe and me, and the weight and the beauty of this responsibility, of the trust the American people have given us, will never leave me.
Meanwhile, Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney survived Republican calls to remove her from GOP leadership. The number three House Republican voted for President Donald Trump's second impeachment. Some Republicans that supported Trump's rejection of the election now say impeachment will further divide the country, but the path to unity goes through accountability, say others. California Democrat Ted Lieu on the House Judiciary Committee told NBC, quote, "We cannot heal as a nation without first having justice," unquote. Chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Benny Thompson in Mississippi, agrees.
You don't resolve the lingering stink that this administration has created by just saying it's over.
Thompson also wants Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Josh Hawley of Missouri punished for leading the effort to refuse certified election results without credible evidence. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of a handful of Republican senators who have signaled they would at least consider the arguments of both sides in the Senate trial. No date has been set.
Donald Trump was a disaster for human rights.
Ken Roth heads up Human Rights Watch, which released its new World Report 2021 this week. He says Trump dismissed refugee rights, empowered white supremacists, undermined LGBTQ rights, revoked environmental protections, and eroded the democratic process, along with America's credibility.
Even though there was an occasional U.S. condemnation of human rights in Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, sometimes China, these rang hollow when there was parallel praise bestowed on the likes of Russia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or Israel.
The report urges Biden to establish a worldwide commitment to human rights that can't be easily reversed by future successors. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe of South Dakota is urging state lawmakers to develop public school programs based on Native American core curriculum. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe wants South Dakota state lawmakers to pass a bill creating community-based schools centered on Native American cultural curriculum. A similar bill failed last session. Lee Strubinger reports.
The Standing Rock Tribe is working hard in many ways to preserve its cultural heritage during the pandemic. Chairman Mike Faith says they're prioritizing COVID vaccines for elders who are fluent language speakers. Faith says the tribe's younger generation needs to learn their language. He says the state could help with that by approving Ocheti Chacoan community-based schools.
It's important for us to allow our students to have a self-identity. You know, we live in an era of loss of identity. If you look back in history, they took that, call it the termination era. You can't speak Indian. You're going to learn how to do this. You're going to learn how to do that. You speak Indian, you're going to get whipped. We're going to punish you. Our language, custom traditions, they went underground.
A similar bill passed the state Senate unanimously last year. Up to four school districts could sponsor an Ocheti Chacoan school in the first 5 years if the bill became law. Those sponsoring districts would transfer funding to the schools based on the percentage of students enrolled to them. It died in the House Education Committee. That committee has a slightly different makeup this year. Democratic State Senator Red Dawn Foster says education should now help restore Indigenous cultural learning rather than assimilation.
We're at a time now that we can use education as empowering our people and bringing our worldview into it and looking at Ocheti Chacoan viewpoints and worldviews and having that. And it's important for our youth to have this for identity and for just academic excellence. It really does show that the more students understand where they come from, their worldview, and what's priority, it's not just good for them as individuals, but for South Dakota in general.
Foster says they're continuing to educate other lawmakers about what the bill does and doesn't do. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre.
Canada's about to get a makeover for its $5 bill. And as Dan Karpinchuk reports, images of four Indigenous finalists are among the nominees.
There are eight finalists to become the next face of Canada's $5 banknote, four of them Indigenous. The list includes Francis Pegamagabo, one of Canada's most highly decorated soldiers of the First World War, Frederick Ogilvie Loft, another First World War veteran, and the leader of one of the country's first national Indigenous political groups. Crowfoot, known for his peacekeeping efforts during the 19th century, and Pitsiolek Ashuna, who became well known for her artwork showing Inuit culture. Brian McInnes is the great-grandson of Francis Pegamagabo. He says his great-grandfather was much more than just a soldier.
Things that we most remember him for are his calmness, his gentleness, his kindness, and his ability to work with all peoples to try to resolve things and try to find a better way forward.
More than 600 names were sent to the Bank of Canada for consideration. From that, an advisory committee pared it down to 8 finalists. The image on the new banknote will be announced soon. It will replace the current $5 bill, which features Sir Wilfrid Laurier, Canada's first Francophone Prime Minister. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Kevin Gover, a citizen of the Pawnee Nation, has been named the Smithsonian's Undersecretary of Museums and Culture. Gover has been the director of the National Museum of the American Indian since 2007, overseeing museums in Washington, D.C. and New York. The undersecretary position oversees Smithsonian history and art museums, cultural centers, archives of American art, exhibits, and national collections. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 15th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as media